That is the percolating beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch. That means it's 8 p.m. on a Thursday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories and the art of telling them right here on KPFT 90.1. Well, I'm your guest host this evening, Eric Heen, along with our regulars of Drs. Hank Rubicek, Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, as well as Greg Audell, and sitting in for Tatiana Gago tonight, we have Nick Allen. We bring you the power of story. We do this by placing the spotlight on guests who'll take you on journeys through the windows of their imagination. Well, today, of course, is the 4th of July, and it's the day we told England to bugger off. So I'm using their own vernacular on them, bugger off. And it's also the kind of day where we just kick back, eat barbecue, and don't take life too seriously. So tonight we're bringing you the kinds of laid-back stories that fit right into that kind of a mood. And we have two accomplished storytellers to share these stories with us this evening. And let's get right to our stories with DC Cornish. Now, to do DC's bio justice, it would take the entire hour. So I'm just going to hit the high points here. DC was raised here in Houston in the historic Fifth Ward. He joined the military and traveled the world where he developed his storytelling skills. He's presently an adjunct professor at Tarrant County College. DC is a five-time champion of Texas State Storyteller competitions. He won the 2015 National Storytelling Network Story Slam. He's recognized by the I Have a Dream Foundation, and DC conducts workshops and seminars on storytelling at everything from elementary schools to major colleges and universities. And DC's nickname is, get this, the Urban Aesop. How cool is that? That's got to be the best nickname I've heard in a long time. Well, before we get to your first story, DC, I want to thank you for coming all the way here from Dallas. You drove here on the 4th of July just to be on our program. Can't thank you enough for that. Well, from looking at your accomplishments...
You're welcome.
Yeah. From looking at your accomplishments, DC, stories play a huge part of your life. And your stories, they're highly entertaining, but you've also said that stories serve deeper purposes beyond mere entertainment. And if you could put it in a nutshell, what purposes do you want your stories to achieve?
Well, when I tell a story, the purpose of the story is oftentimes to inform, entertain, and enlighten. I want them to be different after their storytelling experience than they were before.
Mm-hmm. Great. And now your first story you're going to tell, it's tailor-made for the 4th of July. Wouldn't you say?
Well, I love America. I'm a veteran. Mm-hmm. I'm a veteran and I love America. But I also understand how America works. I'm going to put it for you in a nutshell, okay, really quick. A long, long time ago in a faraway place they call America, once they got their independence from Great Britain, they decided they was going to put together a government. And the government would be divided up into three areas. You had the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. Now, the judicial, them the judges, and the executive, that's the big boss man, but the legislative area, that's where the problem started. Because they was the one that went around and collected the taxes, and they take all the taxes. They got all the money. And then one day, they was all sitting around together, and they said, well, you know what? We need to do something with that money before they find out what's going on. They said, well, what we going to do? They said, well, I know what we're going to do. And they went out, and they bought something that we didn't need. And then they didn't want it. So they spent all our tax money on something that they didn't want, we don't need. Now, they kept it a secret until finally somebody said, you know what, one of these days somebody's going to stumble across that thing. We're going to be in a world of trouble. Said, well, what we're going to do is say, well, this is America. We got magic mountains, amber waves of grain, all this kind of thing. We can find somewhere to put it. So that's what they did. They put it out in the middle of the desert. Now, when they put it out in the middle of the desert, everything was fine for a little while. Until finally one of them fellows, we was all sitting around the table, and one of them said, you know what? It sure would be a shame if somebody went out there and stole all that stuff that we spent our tax money on that they don't want, we don't need. I think we ought to hire a night watchman. So they hired a night watchman to go out there and sit there and watch over the stuff that they don't want, we don't need, that they spent all our tax dollars on. Well, the night watchman was doing his job, and then all of a sudden, one of them guys, they were sitting around that table again. One of them said, "You know what? How we know that night watchman doing his job? We might need to get him a supervisor." So they hired a supervisor to watch over the night watchman, who was watching over the stuff that was out in the middle of the desert that they don't want, we don't need, that they spent all our tax money on. Well, the supervisor was doing his job, and they said, "Well, you know what? We need to get regular reports on what's going on out there." So they hired an administrative secretary for the supervisor who was watching over the night watchman, who was watching over the stuff that was sitting in the middle of the desert that they don't want, we don't need, they spent all our tax money on. Well, things was going along fine. And they said, "You know what? We need to make sure that they're meeting the standards that the government, you know, regulations provide. So we're going to have to get a quality control inspector." So they got a quality control inspector to watch over and read the reports that was written by the administrative secretary, who was watching over and documenting all the actions of the supervisor, who was watching over the night watchman, who was watching over the stuff that they don't want, we don't need, that they spend all our tax money on. And then that's when they decided, said, "You know what? We might need to get a committee together, go out there and look at that thing, see what's going on." So they sent a committee out here. The committee came all the way back to Washington, D.C., and it reported. Told them, said, "That project y'all got going on out there in the desert is way over budget. Way over budget." They said, "Well, what we going to do?" We said, "Well, we need to figure a way to cut the budget." And they came up with an idea. You know what they did?
What?
They fired the night watchman. And that's the way it is,
okay,
in America sometimes. No matter where you start, some good people are always going to end up on the bottom.
Good for the job. But what was in the desert to begin with that they were guarding?
That's what I tell people all the time about storytelling. I say, I leave certain things out because I want to work with the best special effects crew. Mm-hmm. And that's your imagination.
Okay.
What do you think it was?
It's what they call a knowledge gap.
Yeah.
We don't know. Great. Okay, our next storyteller is Wayne McFarland. Okay, brace yourselves for this guy. Wayne is from a small town in the Midwest, but he wandered off many years ago and stumbled into all kinds of escapades, from the Dakotas to California, from Pamplona to Paris, and now he lives in Colorado. And when he's not roping bears and running with bulls, Wayne's dabbling in the print, broadcast, and entertainment industries. And in Wayne's own words, his main claim to fame is, surprisingly, not being dead. Hey, Wayne, how you doing?
Hey, Eric Meister, what's shaking?
Hey, congratulations on not being dead.
I work at it every day.
All right. You know, that's quite an eclectic life you've had, Wayne. I think that's the right word for it. Now, these stories you're going to tell this evening come from your book, Tales of the Day, which is getting great reviews on both Amazon and Barnes & Noble's. And is Tales of the Day, is this essentially your memoirs?
Well, I kind of. You know, I noticed that as all of us mature, a lot of the baby boomer generation starts to decide that the world is desperate to hear how things were. And, Eric, no one cares. Nobody cares if you played kick the can until the sun went down or put roller skates on your shoes with a skate key.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody cares. But yeah. the point I thought was, well, if the story that was just told, if something happens, you know, certain events in life I think have resonance, not just now, but downstream.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the stuff I got involved with, I just kind of stumbled into, and I thought some of the stuff might make a good story. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, these are all true, and they happen to me, although not always my choice.
Gotcha. That's why you say these happen under the heading of oops, That's in your intro of the book.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, your first story is about running with the bulls in Pamplona, Spain.
Yep.
Now, that is one of those things that's on everybody's bucket list. But I think you're the first guy I met who's really done it. You apparently did it, correct?
That's right.
Okay, and before we get to your story, could you give us a brief rundown on what the running of the bulls is all about? I mean, we all know it's bulls chasing drunken tourists down a street. But there's more meaning to it, isn't there? What's it about?
They've traced it back as far as they can, which is about the 13th century. And it started out, according to the research, from people who were raising cattle, having to move the cattle down the streets of a village or a town to pens where they would be sold or killed or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, at some indeterminate point, some of the young lads in the macho spirit decided they would run along with these cows and bulls in the street to prove their manlyhood. And it turned into a fiesta called the Fiesta of San Fermin, which starts in 3 days in Pamplona, Spain. Hmm. And it's gone on for hundreds of years.
Hundreds.
Now it's morphed into something very different than what it was. But according to all the research, is how it started.
Okay, and these bulls that they run, they are the bulls that they later fight in the bull rings, is that correct?
Yeah, what they do is they release six, it's always a dozen, six bulls that are going to be fought in the ring later and killed, complete with wicked horns. They don't cover their horns or anything. And then with them, they release six heifers, but they're big, giant cows, if you will, complete with horns. And they put bells on them. So the theory is they kind of calm the bulls down. I never saw that work, but I understand that's the theory.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, with that background in mind, let's hear your story. It's called The Day I Ran with the Bulls.
Eric, 1.5 million people now pack Pamplona for the San Fermin Festival. And it's covered by ESPN, it's covered by GoPro, Red Bull shows up, and it's a big thing. You've got to make reservations weeks in advance and all of that. But back when I went, the town was about 30,000 people as opposed to 200,000 now. And now you got to get reservations to go. And then we just got on the train. And we had no plan. We were single then, and I had a travel buddy by the name of Bruce. And our big plan was to get out of Paris where we'd had a birthday celebration, and we were terribly hungover. So we just got on a train. And Pamplona, we heard there was a big party. It looked like a good place to go. So we went off on the train. And why we didn't end up dead from salmonella, I don't know, because the trains moved so slowly. How slow did they move? So slowly that you could lean out the window and get egg sandwiches from vendors who'd wrap them in dirty paper and newspapers. I recall them as being delicious, but now it probably violated every health code in the world, you know. When we hit Pamplona, my buddy and I, we had no place to stay, which was okay because we had no money. So we ended up in a park where a lot of campers were, and no sleeping bags. And a guy took a look at us who came over and said, "You boys American?" And it turns out he was a Spanish teacher from Michigan. So we said, "Yeah." And he said, "You don't have a place to stay, do you?" And we said, "No." And so he let us bed down next to his tent and gave us a couple of spare blankets. So that's how we end up staying for the whole festival. 8 days. The goal is to drink all day, party all night, run with the bulls in the morning. Now, two of the three I was rock solid on, all of them except for the bulls thing. So I got to tell you, Eric, all my bragging to the contrary, I would have never run with the bulls if I hadn't stepped on the head of a Norwegian guy. Now, when we actually ran with the bulls, the last I saw this guy until after it was over was when he threw me in a doorway to get me out of the way, and a bull hit him in the chest, and he kind of disappeared in the crowd. And it turns out he was laying on the ground sleeping, and I stepped on his head. And he popped up, and I thought we were going to have a problem. Instead, he held out a big wineskin, and he said, "Let's drink." And it turned out later, I found out he was part of the Norwegian Special Forces, just my luck, right?
Mm.
So we drank his wineskin dry, and then he said, "Okay." And by now, it was time for the running. for that day, about 8 in the morning. He said, okay, you're going to run with me, right? I'll take care of you. We'll have a lot of fun. You're going to run with me, right? And I said, sure, of course. So he took me by the arm, and we went down to the Bull Run, which is some blocks long, all fenced off along the street. And we got down to the run, and I heard a big explosion, which is a rocket they send off to start to let loose the bulls to tell you they're coming. And so he grabbed my arm, and we started running. And suddenly, Eric, I realized we were running in the wrong direction. We were running toward the bulls and not away. And I later found out that the real whack jobs would do that to show their courage. And the problem was the streets were packed with people, and Eric, they were all screaming at the top of their lungs. And you couldn't, the streets were so packed, the only way you could see a bull was when the crowd would kind of pop open. And there would be a bull, which is exactly what you did not want, right? So we're running in the wrong direction. The crowd parts, and there's a bull. And a lot of people in danger do either fight or flight. Well, there's a third option. It's stupidly stand still and stare, which is what I did. And so then the Norwegian threw me out of the way, and that left him open, and he got hit by the bull. And at last, I saw him for a while. So I turned around and started heading in the other direction. And the end of the Bull Run ends up in the Bull Arena, which is another part of the insanity. But as I was running along, I could see the streets were all fenced. So it was like a big, long run, and then the side streets were all fenced off. And a lot of people were trying to climb the fences and roll underneath them to get out of the way of the bulls. And I thought it was a great idea until I noticed people that were jumping up on the fences started falling back in the streets. Because Spanish guys were hitting them in the face, shouting in Spanish, hey, you wanted to run? Well, run! And I noticed most of the people they were smacking were tourists. So I figured better to keep going than to do that. So got to the end of the run, people shouting and hollering the whole way. And then there's a long concrete tunnel that goes into the bull ring. And I'll tell you, Eric, it just scared the devil out of me because I thought, boy, if you get caught in there, and a bull smacks you against the side of the concrete wall, it's going to kill you. And I later found out that what the problem was not that. It was people piling up in the tunnel and suffocating. They called it a monton. So when we ran in the bull ring, we got through that. And I stopped dead again. There were 20,000 people packed in the bull ring, all screaming at us idiots, right? And so I thought, I kind of stood there and looked at it, but I noticed there were a bunch of guys sitting on the sand in the bull ring singing. And I thought, well, here's great local color. So one of them pulled me down. I sat down with them. And then I found out these were the craziest of the crazies who sat in front of where the now really mad bulls ran out to show their courage. So out comes a really angry bull, smacks into the crowd next to me sitting on the sand. And I figured this is the dumbest thing of some dumb stuff I'd done. So I got up and immediately got hit probably by one of the cows because I didn't get gored and thrown into the air, which the singers on the sand, as I called them, thought was hilarious. So the goal of all the runners in the bull ring was to chase the bulls out of the ring into pens. And we did that. And one of the people there, I remember, got gored very badly. And the bull that gored him, the whole crowd jumped on him. Some of them grabbed his tail and pulled him off the guy who was passed over the wall. That was the last bull, and it got chased out of the ring, and we started to leave. And the sand singers came over to me. They thought it was hilarious. Told me I was going to go with them, no choice, right, for a morning of breakfast and drinking more wine, and which I didn't need either. And as we left the bull ring, there was the Norwegian. Sitting on the curb, the bullet hit him and stepped on his foot and torn off 3 toenails. It must have hurt like crazy, and all the guy said was, hey, that was fun. So anyway, a bit later I wandered back to the campground where we had our 2 blankets, and there was my travel buddy. He looked all beaten up, and I said, oh, did you run with the bulls also? And he said, what are you, crazy? He went on to tell me he'd met a young lady, and she'd taken them up to her balcony where they watched the dolts all running with the bulls in the street. And it was really going great, he said, until a couple of guys burst in screaming and using the word hermanos a lot, which is brothers in Spanish. And he said, they threw me down the stairs. Hmm. And then he said, it could have been worse. I said, how could it be worse? And he said, well, they were going to throw me over the balcony. Hmm. So now, Eric, things are changing. I mean, bullfighting's going away, and I think that's a good thing, but I don't think the festival in San Fermín is ever going to die because people want to prove their courage. And as a validation of that, a few years ago, I showed my 16-year-old niece a clip of Running with the Bulls.
Mm-hmm.
And when it was over, I said to her, what'd you think of that? And she looked at me and she said, that's the stupidest thing I've ever seen. What kind of idiot would do that?
Wow.
That's
well,
how
just think about it, Wayne. It is pretty stupid.
Well,
why?
It's a validation, Harry. When you're traveling, don't ever do anything where you end up that you wouldn't do at home.
There you go. So all right.
That's the big part of the rule.
Well, that was a one-time deal, right? You didn't go back and do it again?
No. No, I always threatened to, but my wife said, you don't need to worry about the bulls killing you. You get in the street and run with the bulls, I'll kill you.
There you go. Okay. All right. Thanks, Wayne. Appreciate that.
You're very welcome.
Okay, DC, your next story, it's about an interesting wager you made with one of your commanding officers when you were in the military. And the wager didn't quite work out how you wanted it.
No, it didn't. No, it didn't. Osaka, Japan.
Mm-hmm.
I was attending the University of Maryland at Japan. And I've always been very, very proud of my history and culture as an African American. I think that's the result of me attending a historic black college. And it was a class, it was a history class. And there were some United Nations guys, an Italian guy. And he was there. And I'd already been bragging and, you know, running my mouth. And he finally came up and he said, DC, who was the first black man in space? I told him, Guy Buford. He said, are you sure? I said, yeah, Guy Buford, man. I know for a fact. He said, I don't think so. I said, tell you what, bet $5. Okay. So the next day I go back to the barracks, and I have a copy of the Ebony Encyclopedias with all the important black facts in it, you know. So I pull one down, look through it, and sure enough, there's Guy Buford standing there, NASA, looking good. I grab the book, and the next day I take it with me to school. Take it with me to class, and I lay the book down. And when I lay the book down, I open to the page, and when he comes in, I don't even give him a chance to sit down. I'm like, give me my money. Give me my money right here. There he is, Guy Buford. And then that's when he told me something. He said, no, it's not. I said, man, you're going to give me my money. Now, don't make me put Sergeant Cornish up and pick up Ike from Fifth Ward. You don't want that to happen now. You better give me my money. He said, one moment, Sergeant. And he went and he picked up a book of Russian history. And when he picked up the book of Russian history, he turned to a man named Sergio Mendez. Sergio Mendez was Cuban. He was black. He was also a cosmonaut. And he had beat Guy Buford into space. Because the question was, who was the first black man in space? And that kind of changed my whole focus because I started looking and searching for others. You know, that were little known, like Larry Giles.
Mm-hmm.
Larry Giles was part of the, he was in Warsaw. Black man, he was in Warsaw, resistance fighter, Poland, was Larry Giles. Mary Seacole. Mary Seacole during the wars of attrition in Europe. She did the same thing as, she was a nurse. So I began to find all these different people, and my world began to get bigger. And it began to expand so very, very much, you know, because all of a sudden, I I had broken the restrictions that I had put on myself.
Sure.
And I was able to just get out there and just really discover it, and I love it.
So the first black astronaut went up with the Russians.
He did.
Yeah. Yeah, it shows you we got to think more universally about these things.
Right, right. You know, and it's stop thinking, like I said, having grew up in the era I did have a little bit of tunnel vision. Mm-hmm. I had some tunnel vision. But once that happened, all of a sudden, the world was my oyster.
Yeah. Great story, DC.
You're welcome.
But you lost the bet, but you gained some knowledge there.
Oh, yeah. Best $5 I ever spent.
There you go. Dr. Hank, what's going on?
Oh, okay. Here I am. These are great stories and very, very, very 4th of July friendly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, DC, I love the pattern that you put in your story. You know, your first one reminds me of there was an old lady who swallowed a cow to catch the cow, right? Right? She swallowed the cow to catch the goat. She swallowed the goat to catch the dog. She swallowed the dog to catch the cat. Yeah, that's what it reminded me of. And it really speaks to the similarity between traditional stories and personal stories. And I love that. And Wayne, great story. I love it. I have to take issue with you, though, because Kick the Can. Kick the Can is so pre-boomer. I mean, Hula Hoop, maybe. G.I. Joe, Barbie, but trust me, I am like, you know, I'm Boomer Man, all right? I'm Boomer Man, and I got to tell you, and you're right, you know, I mean, the younger generation doesn't care, but Eric, do I have 30 seconds to tell the story that I shared with you before the show about?
You got it.
Okay. Well, I'm at Starbucks, and I'm coming out, and there are three young ladies around 20 years old excited because they're getting in their car, and I'm asking them, what are you guys so excited about? And they said, well, we want to go and get a great parking space before the crowd hits for fireworks. I said, oh, I played dumb. I do that well. And I said, okay, well, what's going on tonight? It's the 4th of July. I said, oh, well, what's that all about? And one of them said, and really spoke for all three, she said, and I quote, I don't know, but it is so much fun.
No, all right. No.
So I just kind of chimed in, being the educator that I am, and I said, well, let me give you a hand. It's a birthday. And she looked at me, and I swear to God, I wish I was making this up. Oh, my God, I wish I was making this up. But she said, is it your birthday?
Oh, Lord.
You guys have a great time. You guys have a great time. Well, we run into stories like that all the time. That's not quite exactly what you're talking about, but, you know, they need to care about that stuff, I can tell you that. But great stories. Great, great stories. Mm-hmm. Love it.
Well, Dr. Hank, time for our mid-program announcements here.
Right, right, right. Tatiana's not here. We need her. Because obviously she's articulate and I'm not. But thanks to Nick Allen on the boards, we are in excellent hands. Thank you, Nick. Nick, before I talk a little bit about the world of storytelling in Houston, tell our So What's Your Story listeners the name of your music program and time, because it's a great show. I've listened to it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Exactly. Mike's show is on talk show versus with a little bit of music in there. And it actually... It's the name of the show is called Welcome to the Taste, and it's based upon all indie music here in Houston. Mm-hmm. We feature all music people of all kinds, blues, rap, jazz, or whatnot. We serve them that platform just to get their music on out, and we interview them, and we have interviewed some of the more larger artists as well, but we really focus on most of the Houston,
and our shows really have a lot in common, because as Eric will tell you, because he's been on several times as a guest, this is a great venue for people who want to tell stories.
Yes,
it really, really is, and you know, it's a great venue for anybody who cares about this kind of community. But you know, Houston has become a storytelling hub, so much so that it's impossible to cover all the storytelling activities in a few minutes. But let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild holds a story swap the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30, at Temple Emmanuel at 1500 Sunset, which is directly across from Rice University. It's a great place to tell stories to a very supportive group of like-minded people. Their next swap is July 23rd, and for more information, especially about becoming a member, go to www.houstonstorytellers.org. We can't talk cost on Pacifica, but imagine a number less than 30, greater than 20 and has a 5 in it for a one-year membership. Okay, I'm glad you guys. Okay, now while you're on their webpage, click on radio program on the menu to enjoy hundreds of our shows since 2008. You know, so What's Your Story was the first storytelling scene in Houston and is considered by many to be inspiration behind the growth of our storytelling community. So please enjoy our past programs and continue to tune in every week for live stories that connect us to each other. And you don't need a radio to listen to our program. You can listen online at www.kpft.org. And you can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. My God, we're all over the place. Eric, I believe that you are fluttering around the details about another great storytelling venue.
I am fluttering indeed, Dr. Hank. Funny you should use that word, because let's not forget about the Moth Organization.
Yeah, we are so clever. You know, it's almost against the law.
What a coincidence you would use that word. Our friends at the Moth hold a story slam at Warehouse Live on the second Tuesday of every month. Every story slam has a theme, and on next week, on July 9th, the theme will be bold. The doors open at 6:30 and stories start at 7:30. So if you want to hear some bold stories, go to themoth.org and get your tickets to the Story Slam. And even if you don't tell a story there, the Moth is a great venue to observe others and have a great time. Dr. Hank, I hear you're putting your name in the hat for next slam.
You know, I haven't told a story in a while, but I might. I got this story about my pet parakeet growing up, and it was a bold move. And I'll just leave it at there, because I know people are dying to hear it. If that doesn't build the crowd at the Moth, I don't know what will.
I don't know what will.
Right, but it is a wonderful thing. And if I might add, yes, the idea of going to the Moth is great. But, you know, you do not have to tell a story. You know, we on this show want to encourage you to learn to tell stories to our friends, your family. Don't worry about getting up on stage and competing. But the Moth is a great venue to enjoy some of the better tellers around and to really kind of listen to good story models.
Yes.
So thank you for that advice.
Many of the guests here started with the Moth. Okay. Also, I want you to know that we are a very community-oriented program. And so if you have program ideas, suggestions for storytellers, or tell us why you'd be a great guest, drop us a note at story@kpft.org. And I promise we'll get back to you. Well, I'm your guest host, Eric Heen, and you are listening to So What's Your Story? Only on 90.1 Pacifica Radio, fueled for peace. Now, on the show, we often give tips to help you develop your storytelling skills. And this week's tip is this. If you say you don't have any good stories to tell, you're wrong. Because if you made it this far in life, whether you know it or not, you got stories in you. So don't be intimidated if other people are telling stories about climbing Mount Everest or saving babies from a burning building. Some of the best stories I've heard have been about little things, like getting a haircut or a little league baseball game. Stories are everywhere, even in the humblest of places. So our tip this week is to keep your eyes open for the little things in life. And nourish the stories you get from them. And don't be afraid to share them with the rest of us. In other words, great stories come in very small packages. Well, let's get back to our guest storytellers. We have D.C. Cornish here from Dallas and Wayne McFarlane over there in Colorado. Wayne.
Eric.
Your next story takes place in my old stomping grounds in Idaho. What brought you to Idaho?
Well, for reasons I cannot now comprehend. Back in my younger days, I thought it was a great idea to go to Idaho and fight forest fires for a summer. Hmm. We all have our moments of insanity. That was one of mine.
Okay.
So that's how I ended up in the middle of the woods and looking at bears.
Okay. And your next story is called The Day We Roped the Bear.
Yep.
Okay.
Eric, I got to tell you, Eric, if we hadn't been so bored, I swear to you we would not have roped the bear. Hmm. As I say, I went to Idaho to fight fire and was rewarded for my folly by being hired to do it. And they sent us out in a line camp, guys only, which is no longer the case, thankfully, way out in the bushes. And a lot of strange characters there, one of whom became a good friend of mine. He was famous because he was dating the only woman within 60 miles of the camp. So I immediately nicknamed him the Golden Grub, which he hated and stuck to him like glue for the rest of the summer. So anyway, in the camp, there's nothing much to do. The closest town was Orofino, Idaho, which, Eric, you might know. It's a tough little logging town even to these days. And we had no money, the Grub and I, because I'd gotten a lesson in shooting craps in the bunkhouse and lost all my money plus a future paycheck. And the Grub was a worse gambler than I. So evenings and weekends, pretty much, it'd be the two of us sitting around wishing we had better luck or more brains, one of the two. So one day the Grub comes to me, and he says, "Wayne, on a scale of 1 to 10, how bored are you?" And he went on to explain that there were 4 black bears that came down to the dump by the camp for an evening snack every night. And he said they were very friendly, that he'd ascertained that by throwing dirt clods at them to make sure they wouldn't come and tear them limb from limb. So, very encouraged, I stole a rope from the hotshot fire helicopter, and the Grub came up with a railroad tie. I don't know where he came up with that, but it must have weighed about 300 pounds. And we went down one evening to the dump and made a lasso and put it over the only trail going out of the dump and tied the railroad tie to the other end. Sure enough, the bear showed up. We were hiding behind a bush. We hopped up and started screaming at him, which turned out to be a tactical error because of all our bunkmates heard it. And the bears ran to the lasso. 1, 2, 3, gone. The fourth one, Eric, we nailed it. We got right around the head and the front paw. So now the Grub looked at us, and I looked at each other and said, "We roped a bear." And then we thought, now what are we going to do with it? And the bear fortunately solved the problem for us by going up the tallest tree by the dump, which was really tall. And it was just a little thing, it's probably a few hundred pounds, the bear. But it lifted that huge railroad tie right off the ground. And, Eric, if you've ever heard a bear squalling, if you've never heard one, believe me, the shrieks are unbelievable. It's like a loud running your fingers down a chalkboard. So I looked over at the trail toward the bunkhouse, and here came all of our bunkmates running towards us, followed by Ranger Bob, who had no sense of humor, who had a gun and a very grim expression on his face. And he was known for assigning you all the rotten jobs in camp if you did something that he didn't like. So the Grub and I panicked, and we figured the salvation was to get the bear out of the tree. So I leaped up and grabbed the rope, and the Grub grabbed the railroad tie, and we pulled down. And Eric, it was like pulling the chain on an outdoor toilet. The bear immediately unloaded had to be a whole bucket of bear pee on us, followed by a huge load of bear caca. And we were at the base of the tree looking up. And by the time our bunkmates arrived, they started laughing so hard, I thought they were going to have a heart attack. And the ranger walked up to us, and he looked at the bear, and he looked at us, and he fingered his gun, and he said, "I'm just trying to decide who to shoot." And they didn't shoot the bear, thankfully, but they had to cut the tree down to get it out. And it rode the tree all the way to the ground, and the ground's very soft, covered with pine needles. So the bear threw off the rope and just ran off. And so the bear at least got away, and we weren't too damaged by the experience, except at the end of that day, I was walking back to the bunkhouse thinking, boy, the next few weeks are going to be tough here. And there was Ranger Bob sitting on the banks of the Snake River, which ran right by our camp. And as you know, Eric, from Idaho, the Snake is the big river, wild, untamed river. And the ranger was just sitting there staring at it. And I went over to him, and I said, "You mind if I ask you a question?" And he said, "Nah, sure, go ahead." And I said, "That gun of yours, it's awfully small, isn't it? Isn't that a 22? How are you going to kill a bear with that?" And he didn't say a word. He just sat there like I wasn't there and looked at the river. And then he said, I had a lot of guns a year ago, including some that would stop an elephant. And I threw all my guns in the river. Now, Eric, I was just a kid. I didn't know what to say to him. So I threw all his guns in the river. So I sat down, and we just sat there for a minute. And then he said, still looking at the river, he said, everybody said it wouldn't last. She was so much younger than me, but God, I loved her so much. And one day I came home, and I found her with a guy. I knew the guy. I liked him. And by the time I got my gun out and loaded, they were both gone, and I never saw him again. And then he looked at me, and he said, Wayne, in my life, I have never wanted to do anything more than kill them both. So I threw all my guns in the river. And he said, after a while, I didn't want to kill them anymore. And by this time, utter darkness had fallen, the way only dark can fall in the forest. And he got up and went to the ranger's cabin, and I got up and went to the bunkhouse. And Eric, we saw each other every day thereafter for the whole summer. And we never spoke of that evening, ever.
Whoa, Wayne, that's quite a twist there, from the bear end to that guy.
Well, it was quite a day.
Yeah. Now, these stories you've been telling, you're quite a bit younger than them. Are you still rowdy guy as ever, or you've mellowed out a little bit?
Well, I guess it depends on who you ask. Mm. But, this is... You know, what we're doing here is about as rowdy as I get, but okay. It's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. I enjoy it a lot.
Hey, D.C. here is the Urban Aesop. Do you got a nickname, by the way?
Mr. Wonderful.
Okay, well.
Which you're free to use much as you wish.
I'll think of a better one for you before the night's over.
That's my fear.
Okay, thanks, Wayne.
No problem, Eric.
D.C., the Urban Aesop. Let's get back to you. Since we're being so easygoing tonight, I remember you said you wanted to tell a fable, something you tell to the kids.
Yes. I do a lot of work with at-risk kids. I do it. Yeah. And I create my own fables for them. And I'll just tell it to you. Mm-hmm. I was working with a bunch of young people, and it was the mid-2000s, I would say, 2005, 2006. And they were all gangbangers. And I told them a story. I said, once upon a time, there was a field, and in this field was some dogs, old dogs, but one puppy.
Now, the little puppy... He would see this rabbit would stick his head out the hole. He'd see that rabbit, man, be like, man, he'd come after that rabbit. But no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't catch that rabbit. One day he had his mind made up he was going to catch that rabbit. And so when the rabbit popped his head up out the hole, here come the puppy. He chased that rabbit, man. I mean, he chased that rabbit. Now, every time he got through chasing the rabbit, the old dogs would lay under the tree and laugh at him. When he came back, they did the same thing again. But he was so angry this time, he looked at him and said, why don't y'all ever help me try and catch that rabbit? And that's when one of the old dogs told him, said, you ain't gonna never catch that rabbit. Why is that? He said, because you playing. The rabbit is running for its life. And see, oftentimes... Our young people, they don't realize that what you're in the game for, why you in the game, why you go to school, why you need, you know, that's important to understand that that's not where you go to play. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can be the puppy, sometimes you can be the rabbit. Right. And then the other part of the second part of the story is that I'll ask the kids, I'll say, why do you think he was the last rabbit? They'll say, I don't know, Mr. D.C. And I'll tell them, I say, he was the last rabbit because he was smart enough to see what killed all the other rabbits and not make the same stupid mistake. Mm. And see, that's the message there. Mm-hmm. That's the message to them. Don't think you special. If you see somebody doing something wrong and you join in with them, well, hey, whatever happens to them is going to happen to you. Don't make the same mistake.
Yes. I wished I would have known that when I was younger. Yeah, so you're living up to the name with the fables, Urban Aesop. Okay. Now, you told me earlier, DC, something about, I forget how it went, something about the truth versus a parable. How did that go?
Truth and parable. People don't want to deal with the truth. Sometimes the truth is too hard to deal with. But when you dress it in story and make it a parable, it becomes more palatable. That people will sit and they will listen. And oftentimes, they not only will they listen, they will actually put thought into it. Because sometimes the harsh truth, people will run away from that. But if you wrap it in parable, you wrap it in parable and just get it out there for them. The story of the Lozi. There was a man like to fish in the daytime, man like to fish at night. And Lozi people are the nomadic tribe that live on the Zambezi River in Africa. And the one thing that's most important to a Lozi man is a house. So one man starts building a house. And he says, thank my friend the sun in the sky for helping with my house. The night fisherman comes along and he sees the house and he says, oh, this is a sign from my friend the moon in the sky. And both men continue to build until the house is built. And then one man is going there and he pulls up, he puts all his stuff in there. The next man comes up, hey, get off my porch. He said, your porch is my porch. I put in the doors, I put in the floors, I put in the walls, I put in the windows. They just kept going back and forth, back and forth. Until finally one man swung. And now they were fighting. They both were brought to the king. And when they were both brought to the king, he was sitting on a rock. And he said, I hear your witness. You have an honest face, truth. And you know what? The king said, I don't agree with either one of y'all. I agree with the land. The land told me it was here when you got here, and it'd be here when you were gone. This foolishness to fight over such as he. Go and learn to share this land we live in peace for the betterment of all.
Gotcha. Great. Getting sentimental here.
Well, it's a... That's what I do.
Okay. Hey, Wayne, what's your last story called?
It's called The Day We Blew Town with the Monkey.
The Day We Blew Town with the Monkey.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I wanted to say, I was reading the titles of the stories in your book, and just the titles, they kind of tip off the flavor of what's to come in the book. What is like one is The Day We Sparked a Riot in North Dakota, The Day We Got Almost Killed in Arkansas. Just reading the titles of your stories kind of tipped me off to the flavor. But anyway, let's hear about the monkey.
Well, the thing about the monkey, Eric, is I hated the monkey, and the monkey hated me.
Okay.
Now, I can't tell you why I hated the monkey. It could be because it climbed into my bed all the time and then peed in it, or it might be because it pulled down my bookshelves and then crapped on the debris. I don't know. I don't know why the monkey hated me. I never peed in the monkey's bed, and I never crapped on its belongings, but I always did cut the monkey off after two beers, so that might well be it. And, Eric, I didn't acquire the monkey. What I acquired was a roommate, a buddy of mine who was down on his luck, and I let him sleep in my basement. And one day I came home, and there's an empty cage in my living room. And the next day, there's a monkey in it. So I confronted my roommate, and he explained he got the monkey for free, which should have been a dead giveaway. And then he implied that our liberal arts college, which taught, like, medieval art, had an interest in vivisecting a monkey. And I never asked, which was part of my stupidity. So, but anyway, I'll tell you, Eric, at first the monkey was great. I mean, we were really popular. My roommate would take it to the local bar, and the monkey would poke its head out because it was winter in Minnesota. And we would get free drinks all night, and the ladies would come over, and we could invite them home to see the monkey in its natural habitat. So all of that was going great until one night something spooked the monkey in the bar. And it ran screaming up and down the bar. And they have a prehensile tail, which is like an extra hand. And it started throwing bottles off the back bar and spilling drinks and peeing on everybody. And they threw my roommate and the monkey out of the bar, saying, if you ever come back, we'll have you arrested. Now, what they were going to bust the monkey for, I don't really know. But we started having, because we couldn't go out, so we started having game night at our house. We'd invite our friends over, and we'd cook up big bowls of popcorn and serve beer. We discovered a beer called Chief Oshkosh Beer, which was $1.25 an 8-pack. It was cheaper than Coca-Cola. And the problem was, the monkey loved popcorn, as it turned out, so we couldn't serve it in big bowls because people thought popcorn covered in monkey spit was not good. And it also loved beer. So anybody who left their beers sitting around in the bottle, the monkey would take it, wrap its hands and its feet and its tail around the bottle, and chug it, which, Eric, is like you or I sucking down like 2 or 3 gallons of beer without stopping. And I noticed that after a couple of Chief Oshkosh beers, the monkey got really grumpy. So I always cut it off. So maybe that was the problem. Anyway, at a certain point, I decided I wanted to go to California and make my fortune. And my roommate and his girlfriend asked if we could detour to Boston. Because I had an ex-girlfriend out there, so I thought that was a good idea. And my roommate's girlfriend had a job pending, so the only problem was they wanted to take the monkey. And I wanted no part of that. I hated the monkey. And it almost became a self-serving problem, or a self-serving solution, rather. Because one day we came home, and there was no monkey. The cage was empty. It had gotten out. My roommate was really upset. He'd named the monkey Cheetah, which I thought was really a dumb name, like naming a dog Spot. But he was so upset. We looked all over the house, and it was winter in Minnesota. We couldn't find the monkey. So I figured, oh, great, the monkey's a popsicle by now. So my roommate was really upset. I said, look, I think there's a couple of stray bottles of Chief Oshkosh in the fridge. Let me grab them, and we'll commiserate the loss of the monkey. So I opened the fridge door, and Eric, there was the monkey. It had taken a bite out of everything in our fridge, peed on the pizza, and was gnawing on the top of one of the Chief Oshkosh bottles of beer. Couldn't get it open, though. And my roommate, I tried to slam the door shut quick, but my roommate saw it, grabbed the monkey, and saved it by basking it in the warm air from a hairdryer. And the only problem with this is that the monkey loved the experience, and afterwards would drag around the hairdryer, and if it found you and you didn't plug it in and warm the monkey, it would bite you. So anyway, the time came to leave, and we still hadn't resolved the monkey issue. And my roommate's girlfriend said, look, I'll carry the monkey the whole way to Boston on my lap if you'll take it. And I said, well, okay. I had a van. So we all piled into the van, and my roommate's girlfriend carried the monkey on her lap, and that lasted about 15 minutes until the monkey's bladder problem reasserted itself. And that was the end of that. And thanks to the monkey, Eric, we couldn't even eat at restaurants. We had to eat in the van because the first time we stopped to have lunch, suddenly the horn started blaring nonstop. A little kid runs in and says, there's a van with a monkey in it. Cleared out the restaurant, and the monkey discovered that if he sat on the horn, it would bring his pack mates back, us, usually with food, right? So we finally made it to Boston. The van smelled heavily of monkey, which is probably no surprise. The girlfriend, my roommate's girlfriend, and my ex-girlfriend started rooming together and said they'd babysit the monkey. And, Eric, that lasted about a day until their landlord dropped by and asked if they were torturing a little child in their apartment. So we got the monkey back, and that lasted about 2 hours until our landlord came by and said, either the noise stops or you leave now. So later that afternoon, my roommate said, can I borrow the van? And I said, sure, and he left with the van and the monkey. And he came back and asked to borrow the van in the morning, and he left with the van and the monkey. And then he came back with the van and no monkey. And I said, oh, okay, I give up. Where is that beer-swilling little SOB? And my roommate said, Cheetah is in a happier place. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, God, I hated that monkey, but I didn't want it murdered. And my roommate said, oh, no, no, I couldn't kill the monkey. And he went on to explain he had found a children's TV show that was could not believe their luck to get a live monkey free. And my roommate swore he did not get paid for the monkey, but he started picking up all the tabs after that. So I've been highly suspicious for years. And anyway, without the monkey, we at the time were trying to make money with a multi-level soap business, which was not well received in Boston. So we finally went broke, disposed of the rest of our soap in a dumpster. I headed off to California. My roommate got a job in Rhode Island. And months later, I got a letter from my ex-girlfriend. And she went on to explain that the monkey now had its own TV show. Uh-huh. And it was so popular, it was getting written up every day in the Boston papers.
Well, yeah.
And in her letter, she said, well, at least one of you made it in Boston. And, Eric, I thought that was kind of harsh, actually. Yeah. But in the end, truly, we all went broke in Boston.
Yeah.
And a monkey became a TV star.
Right. Well, I think he's better off there than in your refrigerator there, Wayne. So
I would have to agree.
Okay. Well, we're getting short on time here. But I want to say that storytellers like you guys here, you even though storytelling is getting lost in the shuffle of TV and the internet these days, storytelling is not a lost art. People can still gather around campfires or sit on the porch and listen to Grandpa's yarns. And let's not ever lose that.
Grandpa? What do you mean, Grandpa?
Yeah, I'm a grandpa. And you know what? I'm apparently near deaf. What is wrong with you people? Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, you're a grandpa too? Good.
So when Grandpa goes, his stories are either going to die with him or live on for us to tell our own grandkids. I'm trying to be sentimental, guys. It's up to us, folks. Listen to Grandpa.
My 4-year-old niece comes up to me, drops a bunch of dirt in my hand, and said, my mom said you're older than that. Is that true?
Yeah. Okay, Dr. Hank.
I just wanted to tell Wayne that I understand the monkey problem. It's because he had a Tempur-Pedic. Just wanted to share that with you.
Oh, okay. Geez, just shoot me now, would you?
It's a Dr. Hank joke. We got to get one of those in there.
Okay, very good.
Well, don't you dare move, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on Tennyson's Tape Deck. Make 90.1 a part of your everyday life. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story, and treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Eric Heen, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
If you decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them to make a donation in your honor to KPFT. Thanks again for supporting 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. Pacifica Radio for Peace.
This year, let's go green. To save money in trees, the local station board election will use electronic ballots. Members in need of a paper ballot can leave a voicemail for the election supervisor at 510-854.